Well, amazingly, we were able to finish the book of Joshua, and today we are going into the book of Judges. As I was trying to make a few sermons out of this book, there are so many things that we actually have to deal with. And besides that, I think the days of Judges give us a lot of lessons. I think there are a lot of things we'll be able to glean from this particular book. So instead of going into any one particular passage of the scriptures and expound it as I have been doing today, I want to give you some overview of the book of Judges. In the meanwhile, I hope that we'll be able to find some very important truths and very important points that we should be able to learn tonight. So, though we chose the passage from Judges chapter 1 verses 1 to 20, probably my talk is going to be all over the places, and hopefully we'll be able to glean some ideas about this book and the days of the judges. William Harvard, who lived in 1710 to 1778, an English poet and dramatist, said this, in quote, "The greatest glory of freedom, people is to transmit that freedom to their children," end of quote. John Philpott Curran said, in quote, "Eternal vigilance is the price of freedom," end of quote. One of the most outstanding privileges that the children of Israel had in the promised land was their freedom. Finally, they are free from the bondage of the Egyptians. They were not under the bondage of any nation or any tribe. They did not have to wander around a desert anymore in order to find their permanent home. They did not have to move from place to place because now in Canaan they had a permanent place they could call home. The administrative government was not a pagan anymore but of their own. They finally were able to establish a nation in the land, a free land as a free people. However, the freedom their ancestors had to fight for or longing for was not considered as a privilege anymore, but the succeeding generations treated it as if it was always there, it had been always there, it was their right, and they had been free and would be free forever. The years of the judges were dominated by that sort of mentality. The book we are going to study is very, very different from other books of the Bible in terms of religion, in terms of politics, in terms of ways of life, in terms of community spirit. I think we can relate all those things we can find from the book of Judges to the current affairs in this country, England, for example, or the United Kingdom. So let us study some things from this book. First of all, let's consider the background materials. I have gleaned some information about the book and its historical background from Cyril J. Barber's commentary on the book of Judges, and I found that some of his points were very excellent, so I decided to use some of his points to be mine today. In order to understand the book, we need to consider a few questions first. The first question is about a few seeming discrepancies between the book of Joshua and the book of Judges. Again, I think I need to go through some of those points first so that just in case in the future if you have some problems with these books, I think you should be able to know that there are no discrepancies, but they are only the seeming apparent discrepancies. They are not real discrepancies. Sometimes I deal with this sort of questions before dealing with other more expository and prominent points. It is because there are always challenges from the critical, scholars or unbelieving people who are trying to discredit the scriptures over certain teachings and passages. And especially when you are reading certain books, when you are choosing certain commentaries, you should be able to detect those problematic issues so that you can set those books aside from your reading. I want you to know that one of the greatness of Bible-based faith of Christian faith and Christian religion is that it offers everybody and everyone opportunities to think for themselves and does not oppress others' conscience or their reason. The Bible has withstood the challenges of all the criticisms from every imaginable sector of the mankind for the last 2,000 years. Christian religion is not a religion. It is not like a religion that muzzles the mouths of the people and kills anyone who raises different opinions, especially we are not living in the medieval times these days. However, we should be able to provide those critics with some answers and to defend our faith at the same time. One of the most significant challenges comes from seeming discrepancies in the series of the conquest stories in the book of Joshua, in the book of Judges. First of all, Joshua chapter 21, verses 43 to 45 say this. Joshua 21, 43 to 45. And the Lord gave unto Israel all the land which he sware to give unto their fathers, and they possessed it and dwelt therein. And the Lord gave them rest round about, according to all that he sware unto their fathers. And there stood not a man of all their enemies before them. The Lord delivered all their enemies into their hand. There failed not aught of any good thing which the Lord had spoken unto the house of Israel. All came to pass. It seems that from this passage, we find that there are affirmations of the annihilation of any enemy forces and the fulfillment of God's promise of the land to the patriarchs. So, having read that particular passage of the scriptures, our immediate impression is that, wow, conquest is over. Military campaign was successfully finished and completed, and the whole land was conquered. Well, then we read Judges chapter 1 verse 10. Judges 1:10 says, And Judah went against the Canaanites that dwelt in Hebron. Now the name of Hebron before was Kirjath Barba. And they slew Sheshai and Ahiman and Talmai. It appears that it is a different account from Joshua chapter 10 verses 36 and 37. Because Joshua chapter 10 verses 36 and 37 say this, Joshua went up from Eglon and all Israel with him unto Hebron. In Judges chapter 1, Judah, the tribe of Judah, was going after Hebron, and there was a conflict. Military conquest again. Military campaign again. However, Joshua chapter 10, verse 36, here, all Israel with Joshua went to Hebron, they fought against. And verse 37, and they took it. And he says, they took it and smote it with the edge of the sword, and the king thereof, and all the cities thereof, and all the swords that were therein, he left none remaining, according to all that he had done to Eglon, but destroyed it utterly, and all the swords that were slain. So, Joshua chapter 10 clearly tells us that actually Joshua with all Israel went up to Hebron and fought against it, conquered it. And verse 37, Joshua chapter 10 says that even the king, all the cities, all the inhabitants in the city were totally annihilated, totally destroyed. Therefore, when we come to Judges chapter 1 and read that the tribe of Judah had to defeat the Amorites in Hebron, we become puzzled. Though we briefly touched, in fact, on this matter last week, it may be helpful for us to see a record from Judges chapter 1 verses 19 to 36. In fact, if you look at, from verse 21, for example, Judges chapter 1 21 says about the failure of Benjamites. And verses 22 to 29, it talks about the failure of the tribes of Joseph. So, Ephraim and Manasseh. And verse 30 is talking about failure of Zebulun. And verse 31, it talks about the failure of Asher. And verse 33 talks about failure of Naphtali. And verses 34, 5, 36, it talks about failure of Dan. So, having read from the book of Joshua, we had an impression that all the land was conquered. But here, in Judges 1, it seems that there are not The lands that had not been conquered yet, and these tribes went after these lands, but eventually they failed to conquer those pieces of land. The passage speaks about many localized fights and efforts of the rest of the tribes to obtain the land. If we continue to read the book of Judges, we feel that the conquest was not actually completed, and there were protracted wars continually. If we read the book of Joshua, we think that the conquest was swift and very quick. However, the book of Judges gives us a totally different sort of idea and impression. I believe that there are some answers we can provide for such questions. The first thought is that it is not necessary for us to read the book of Judges, at least chapters 1 and 2, chronologically. For example, Judges chapter 1 verse 1 says, "Now after the death of Joshua, it came to pass that the children of Israel asked the Lord, saying, 'Who shall go up for us against the Canaanites to fight against them?'" So, Judges chapter 1 verse 1 seems to indicate that the contents of this book are all those events after Joshua died, as Judges 1:1 says. So we expect that the following passages are records of the subsequent events after Joshua's death. However, it doesn't have to be so. It is because if we are going to read Judges chapter 2 verse 6, it says, "And when Joshua had let the people go, the children of Israel went every man onto his inheritance to possess the land." So here, the verse speaks about a convocation over which Joshua presided before his death. So chapter 1 verse 1 is talking about death of Joshua, but chapter 2 verse 6 is talking about his presence in the meeting. Therefore, chapter 1 and chapter 2, we do not have to necessarily, it is not necessary for us to see those two chapters chronologically. So, there are occasions to look into history during the times of Joshua, even in the latter part of the book, beyond chapter 1 verse 1, which has the record about the death of Joshua. So if we look at some of the events in the second half of Judges 1, we find a commonality between this passage and Joshua chapters 14 to 19. Because Joshua chapters 14 to 19 are talking about those localized conflicts between different tribes and the local people. Therefore, it seems that the second half of Judges 1 and Joshua chapter 14 to 19, there are a lot of common things, and so it is very possible that those two sections of the scriptures are basically dealing with the same issues. Such corresponding descriptions should not surprise us, because each record in the scriptures has its own purpose. So, Judges 1 and 2 show some disastrous consequences of certain actions shortly before and after the death of Joshua. The overall impression we receive from Judges chapters 1 and 2 is probably the same one, that the children of Israel were not perfect even during the days of Joshua, though they were better than the days after the death of Joshua. Probably that was the reason why Joshua, in his last speech in chapter 24, which is the last chapter of the book of Joshua, he exhorted the people to make a choice between God and pagan, and idols. And if the Israel has been able to demonstrate her faithfulness to the Lord and so on, probably there was no necessity for him to do so. So it seems that there are indications that even during the days of Joshua, certain people in Israel were not still faithful to God. I do find the uniqueness of the material in Judges 1, which is about the tribe of Judah. All other tribes in chapter 1 failed. This tribe failed, that tribe failed, that tribe failed, and so on. So it is just a series of stories about failures of different tribes. However, though there was an incomplete element the overall performance of the tribe of Judah in Judges 1 was very good and successful. It's quite interesting. Why only the tribe of Judah was successful while other tribes were unsuccessful? In particular, Judges 1, verse 19, the first part of verse 19 says that the Lord was with Judah. So it is no wonder that Judah was able to succeed. The Lord was with Judah. Why? Why only the tribe of Judah and the rest of the tribes are so miserably failing? I think that it has a significant lesson to the kingship coming from the tribe of Judah. As you know, David came from the tribe of Judah and he was the king, and David's kingship is forever. We all know that one of the characteristics of the book of Judges is found from a repeated statement, in fact. In those days, Israel had no kings. It's found in chapter 17, chapter 18, chapter 19, chapter 21. So it is a repeated statement throughout the book of Judges. The writer of the book appears to indicate that the chaos, spiritual and moral declines, and military failures were related to the absence of the kingship in the country. In those days in Israel, there was no king, no king, no king. At the same time, a victorious story by the tribe of Judah, in contrast to the rest of the tribes, does make the tribe of Judah later on very much outstanding over all other tribes. In the future, kings came out of the tribe of Judah. And here is the beauty of studying the scriptures very carefully with some thinking mind. The repeated refrain, in those days Israel had no king, that very statement, by the way, is an indication that the book of Judges was completed not during the times or days of Judges, but after Israel had a king. It is an indication that the date of the writing of the book of Judges was after there was a king in Israel. It means that the earliest possible time of its writing could not be before the time of Samuel, who anointed both Saul and David to be the kings of Israel. A slow and gradual conquest was not an accidental thing. In fact, it was not unexpected, but in fact, gradual and very slow conquest was a plan of God. In fact, that was very much providential. If you read Deuteronomy chapter 7, would you like to turn your scriptures to Deuteronomy chapter 7? We are going to read verses from 21 to 24. Deuteronomy chapter 7. Let's read it together. Thou shalt not be affrighted at them, for the Lord thy God is among you, a mighty God and terrible. And the Lord thy God will put out those nations before thee by little and little. Thou mayest not consume them at once, lest the beasts of the field increase upon thee. But the Lord thy God shall deliver them unto thee, and shall destroy them with a mighty destruction until they be destroyed. And he shall deliver their kings into thine hand, and thou shalt destroy their name, able to stand before thee, until thou have destroyed them. Amen. So, right from the beginning, even before the children of Israel entered into the promised land, it was God's plan. God said, I will let you conquer the land little by little. And in fact, there are two different purposes why he did it. One purpose is shown here, and another purpose is shown some other places, in fact, in the book of Joshua and the book of Judges. And one of the reasons that God did not give them a whole land at once, you know, settle everything, it is found in verse 22. And the Lord thy God will put out those nations before thee by little and little. Thou mayest not consume them at once, lest the beasts of the field increase upon thee. So that is one of the reasons. Therefore, complete and quick and speedy recovery was not a part of God's plan, but actually, providentially, God planned that the children of Israel will gradually conquer the land. The second area of the background we need to know about is of all overall information about the community of Israel during the years of the judges. We need to begin with their economy. Overall impression you can get from the book of Judges is that they were very poor and they were needy. Besides that, they were not prosperous at all. Isn't it interesting? They were coming into the promised land. They were settled in the promised land. Flowing of milk and honey. That is the description of the promised land. But they were not prosperous at all in the promised land. We are not talking about in Egypt, in the wilderness, but in the promised land. They failed to possess every part of the promised land. Some nations occupied and controlled major traveling and trading routes, some roads. Some areas were occupied by powerful enemies with even chariots of iron. And they must be drawn by horses, which meant that they were very dangerous threats in wars. Some of the rocky highland areas were also taken by the enemies. It means that they lost their trading routes and they had to live under constant threats from these powerful neighboring enemies. They did not have complete peace, but only partial and sometimes compromised peace. They also suffered financially and economically. They had to find ways to coexist with the people who constantly threatened their security. It was totally opposite of what God had planned for them, in fact. The children of Israel were not able to manufacture their own tools, weapons, and farm implements. If you know that during the time of King Saul, only he and his son Jonathan had proper weapons. Can you imagine that? It was supposed to be a nation and kingdom, but they did not have any skills, talents, or resources to make the weapons with iron. It must not surprise us that when David had to fight against Goliath, he had to use only the slingshots. If he did not want the slingshots, only the weapon or his, kind of some sort of equipment to fight such a giant, those equipments or tools or weapons must be provided by King Saul. But King Saul was a big man and Daniel was not that big. And so whatever was given by Saul was too big for him. So after all, he could not use them. For farming, they needed iron tools. But they could not produce them for themselves. So they had to go to the Philistines. They had to depend on their neighbors who were not their friends. The Philistines had profited from the trading with the children of Israel at least for 250 years. So financially and economically, Israel was not doing at all. Politically speaking, Israel was not doing at all, really. Israel suffered with disunity internally. If you read Judges 1 and the rest of the book, it is not too hard to find that there were disunity. There was disunity amongst themselves. If there were common enemies, then only some of the tribes got together. They cooperated with other tribes and they went out to fight and so on. But most of the times, they were just left alone. It is no wonder that they could not conquer the whole land at all. And we also need to know that the disunity of Israel was also caused by their inability to defeat all the enemies in the land. As we saw before, many parts of the land were occupied by powerful enemy forces, and their unity was easily disrupted. On the other hand, the common bond among them had been weakened over the years. Spiritually speaking, there are many clear indications that they fell into apostasy. It is not just a couple of incidents by chance or by mistake, but it has been habitual practice, in fact. Judges chapter 2 verses 11 to 13 is a good example to illustrate the point. Judges 2:11 says, "And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served Baalim. And they forsook the Lord God of their fathers, which brought them out of the land of Egypt, and followed other gods of the gods of the people that were round about them, and bowed themselves unto them, and provoked the Lord to anger. And they forsook the Lord and served Baal and Ashtaroth." It helps us to understand why God commanded, even before they came into the promised land, to remove all Canaanite tribes from the land and not to intermarry with them. Because there was a danger of apostasy. And God told them so many times through His servants, Joshua and Moses, to the people that they should not follow after other gods in the promised land. When Israel failed to stamp out idolatry, what was waiting for them was not only their spiritual bankruptcy, but also consequences of their sins. But real tragedy is that all of them were taken place in the promised land. Land of freedom. Concerning spiritual problems, we cannot say that the ordinary people and political leaders were the ones to blame for all their miseries. In fact, if we read the book of Judges carefully, we will find quite a number of indications that the spiritual leaders, such as the priests and the Levites, became apathetic toward the spiritual realities. It is not hard to find that some gave up so-called their ministries as priests and the Levites. And also some of the priests took up religious jobs under the auspices of wealthy patrons. So they were supposed to serve the Lord, worship God in God's tabernacle, but instead they became priests and the Levites serving people in individuals' homes for families, wealthy families. When Israel fell into spiritual bankruptcy, these religious leaders also suffered with moral bankruptcy. May I say that this sort of setting provides all the necessary environments even for even more apostasy. People wanted to depend on some sort of objects for their material prosperity, and they were under constant threats and financial difficulties and afflictions and so on. So idolatry appealed to their flesh more than a true and spiritual religion of God. They wanted to have some tangible things in order to believe in God. Sometimes I'm just wondering whether some of the charismatic leaders are actually encouraging to people to follow this path. The third area of our study is of the name of the book, Judges. The Hebrew term for judges comes from a verb meaning to judge, as you can imagine. Judges chapter 2, verse 16 and 18 explain it in part. Judges 2:16 says, "Nevertheless, the Lord raised up judges, which delivered them out of the hand of those that spoiled them." So, first of all, the reason that God called judges was to make them as the deliverer. So they were supposed to be the military commanders so that they could fight against the enemies, and they were able to deliver the people from the hands of the enemies. Verse 18 says, "And when the Lord raised them up judges, then the Lord was with the judge, and delivered them out of the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. For it repented that the Lord because of their groanings by reason of them that oppressed them and vexed them." And then, so military commander, that was one of the roles they were supposed to play. So even though the name is judge, they were not just a sitting judge, but they were military commanders. Secondly, there were basically three roles that judges had to play. One is to return the hearts of the people to God by forsaking their idolatry. So they were almost like prophets. They were speaking to the sinful nation to return.
to God.
So, Judges chapter 2 verse 17 can be a very, very good example. 17 shows the spiritual problem of the children of Israel. And 2:17 says, "And yet they would not hearken unto their judges, but they went to whoring after other gods, and bowed themselves unto them. They turned quickly out of the way which their fathers walked in, obeying the commandments of the Lord, but they did not so." So it seems the judges were talking to them that they must return to God. The second role, another role they had to play was obviously a military commander. Because of their idolatry, oftentimes God disciplined them, chastened them by sending them powerful enemy forces. So as a result, through these neighboring nations and countries, the children of Israel had to suffer a lot. In times of adversity, God's people succumbed to the oppressive policies of the nations more powerful than themselves. If they repented and turned to God, then God sent the deliverers and they were the judges. And God commanded the judges to be over Israel according to 2 Samuel chapter 7 verse 11. So they were to make God's will known among the people and to serve as the military commanders. And the third role is not very clear. It's not very clear. However, it seems that there must be a role for the judges in the administrative part. In other words, magistrate's work. Deuteronomy chapter 1 verses 16 and 17 say this, "And I charge you, your judges at that time, saying, hear the causes between your brethren, and judge righteously between every man and his brother, and the stranger that is with him. Ye shall not respect persons in judgment, but ye shall hear the small as well as the great. Ye shall not be afraid of the face of man, for the judgment is God's. And the cause that is too hard for you, bring it unto me, and I will hear it." So the judges seem to be the people who made all those decisions between, you know, right and wrong for the people. The judges were chosen from the individual tribes. Their primary duty was to deal with various legal cases to make right legal judgments. They were not the same kind of judges we can see actually from the book of Judges. However, judges in the book of Judges seem to have some of those capacities within their roles to play. And judges were deliverers. And after they delivered their people, they ruled over them for the rest of their life. So that's why sometimes people are talking about Deborah in a slightly different term. Because Deborah herself was not a military commander, while the rest of the judges seemed to get involved in the military conflicts, and they were the generals, and they were the ones who actually went out to fight against the enemy forces. So some commentators are making some differentiations between Deborah and the rest of the judges. And I think we are going to... Am I going to study Deborah? I think I'll plan to study Deborah. So we will deal with that issue when the time comes. And fourth, we need to study about the extent of the period of the judges. It is very hard. I do not deny that there are some controversies related to this very issue. When was the period of judges in Israeli history? The difficulty comes from a simple mathematical calculation. I did not give you a chart, but I have a chart to know all those kind of years and things like that. You know, here are the judges' names and how long they were judges, and through their ministries or their contributions, how many years Israel enjoyed the peace. So when we add them all up, we find some problems. If we add up all the numbers of years we find from the book, the number of years appears to be far greater than we can fit into the historical setting. Thus, some rash critics again jump into making a conclusion that, you see, the Bible must not be correct, or the dates of Exodus must be changed from the date we have trusted so far. This controversy itself is too huge to talk about within a message. Even if I spend the whole time of this message, I may not be fully tell you about the nature of the controversy. However, I want to give you a simple solution or very feasible and possible answer to all these challenges. The problem is stemmed from a presupposition that all the judges had lived in different times, and there was no time when more than one judge lived together. Because of the presupposition, here is one judge, here is another judge, and they have lived in all different timetables in the table of the history, so when we add them up a lot in number. But that is only an assumption. In fact, this presupposition is not to be true. It is more than possible that more than one judge lived together in the same era. Then problem does not exist anymore. Then all those seeming problems vanish away. Then I would say that the period of the judges was between 1360 and 1051 BC. Well, I guarantee you that you will find some different numbers from different commentaries. Then do not think that I'm wrong. I will give you some room to move around in terms of those numbers. And I will just give you my reasoning of the calculation that I have put. All right? I'm not sure what sort of outlines I gave you here, whether you can figure the things out. Okay, here we go. We must begin with the date of the entry of the Promised Land by the children of Israel. And evangelical and conservative Christians have always taken it to be 1405 BC. That's the time to enter into the Promised Land. That means the year or the date of Exodus is supposed to be 1445 BC, because the children of Israel were wandering around in the wilderness for 40 years. So Exodus 1445 BC, entry into Canaan 1405. The first major military campaign was over 7 years after entering the Promised Land. This figure is based on Joshua chapter 14, verse 7 and verse 10. Joshua 14:7 says this, 40 years old was I when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land, and I brought him word again as it was in mine heart. So, the spying out, that's the second year in the wilderness, and that was the time when Caleb was 40 years old. So from that time till the time of the entry into the Promised Land, 38 more years left. So 40 years old in the second year in the wilderness, then 38 more years. So by the time he entered into the Promised Land, he became 78 years old. Then verse 10, and now behold, the Lord hath kept me alive, as he said, these 40 and 5 years, since the Lord spake this word unto Moses, while the children of Israel wandered in the wilderness, and now, lo, I am this day 85 years old. So he became 85 years old. So by the time of most of the conquest to be done, he was 85 years old, which means the year when he entered into the Promised Land, he was 78, and now he's 85 years old. So it seems that the military conquest was continued for at least 7 years by this time. So the figure comes from there. I'm not sure after this how many more years Joshua lived in Canaan. And how many years his generation, elders from his generation lived, even after Joshua died. So, you know, there is no indication in terms of years and numbers and things like that. So I decided to give about 30 years. So, 7 years in the land of the promised land. So when actually Caleb was talking to Joshua in chapter 14, Joshua chapter 14 verse 10, it is supposed to be 1398 BC. Because entering 1005, so minus 7, so 1398. And I decided to give about 30 years for Joshua and the elders who outlived Joshua after he died. So I deducted 30 more years. So it became 1368 BC. Then we come to Judges chapter 3 verse 8. Is it? 3:8. Israel was under the oppression of Cushan-Rishathaim, a king of Mesopotamia, for 8 years. And the first judge was Oniel, who delivered Israel from Mesopotamian king. So, 1368, and from that moment until the first judge was to be called out by the Lord, that took about 8 more years, because Israel was under the oppression of this particular king for 8 years. So I deducted 8 more, so it became 1360 years. You may be wondering why I am spending so much time to talk about these numbers. And you will find the reason why a bit later. So my rough number is 1360. It can be 1370 or 75, 80. It's very possible. But this is just one of those suggestions. So I do not claim that this figure is exact, because there are uncertain things we do not know about. But you understand the logic behind. The end of the judges' era is even more difficult to know. Samuel was the last judge. The period of the judges officially must have ended with the accession of Saul to the throne. And now there was a king, and judges were not the rulers of the land anymore. And there is a general consensus that Saul's reign began in the year of 1051 or 1050 BC, and he ruled 40 years. If we consider all these numbers, then the time frame given to the book of Judges is only about 209 years. Let me say about 210 years. It's okay. So about that is the number of years that may cover the whole duration of the years of the judges. A challenge comes into this way of understanding of the judges. It is because of what Acts 13 verse 20 says. So we are going to read Acts chapter 13 verse 20. Let's read it together. And after that, he gave unto them judges. You read it, and now you have an impression here from this verse. And after that, he gave unto them judges about the space of 450 years until Samuel the prophet. Oh, wow. It says that there were 450 years, not 209 years. Here we go. What shall we do? It seems that it is really irreconcilable number. I mean, if the number difference is 20 or 30, we can put the things into a very nice perspective. However, if the difference is over 200 years, it is very hard to put everything together. And so how can we, 309 years, I'm sorry, right? 390 years. So, it seems that the numbers actually do not go together. It seems that there are huge differences. And so as a result, if you read the different Bible commentaries, you will see that all these Bible commentators do give you different ideas and different suggestions so that, things can be more understandable and so on. And in order to understand it, I think there are a few things we need to consider. Number one, in the Bible, often round numbers are used. So 450 years. 450 years doesn't have to be 450 years exactly. Maybe 449 years, 447 years, or 451 years. But still, oftentimes, there are round numbers used. Second, we need to pay attention to the fact that Paul preached to the Jewish audience in the synagogue, and the Jews did not protest over his historical accounts. They did not say, "Hey, Paul, the number that you just quoted in your message is not right. It's a terribly, terribly wrong number. You know, there is something. Well, no, there was no protest. They knew and understood what he had to say was correct. Therefore, we must understand that the first century Jews did not have any trouble with Paul's remark concerning 450 years. Then our question is on how to understand it. In order to see the issue more clearly, I decided to look into other translations to know how others saw the issue. So I have chosen three most popular translations. So I gave you all those translations, and ESV says all this took about 450 years, and after that he gave them judges until Saul, Samuel the prophet. You know, there is a very kind of tricky translation. You see, if you read this, it says this: all of this took about 450 years, period. So in other words, that sentence is related to the preceding passage rather than it is related to the statement right next to it. So all of this took about 450 years, and after that, God gave them judges until Samuel the prophet. So 450 years does not have anything to do with the judges, but they are having something to do with the preceding events. How about NAS? NAS says, and after these things, he gave them judges until Samuel the prophet. So NAS basically gives us the same impression. After these things, so previous things, whatever they are, he gave them judges until Samuel the prophet. So 450 years does not have anything to do with the judges. How about NIV? NIV says all this took about 450 years, period. After this, God gave them judges until the time of Samuel the prophet. So all of these translations are giving us an idea that actually 450 years do not have anything to do with the duration or period of the judges, but they are related to the preceding one, preceding passage. So there are a few observations from this comparative study we need to do. First of all, I do not like ESV and NIV on this verse. They are taking too much freedom on this translation, especially I think NIV gives us a lot of a free translation, though, you know, it may make a sense. ESV and NIV on this verse both begin with the phrase "or this." And I must say that it is a very presumptuous translation with a presupposed idea to indicate that all of this include all the historical times and events from the preceding verses rather than the years, 450 years, are to be attached to the following statement in the same verse. So you need to know what is happening in the preceding passage. So Acts chapter 13, verses 16 to 20, let me read it for you, okay? Acts 13, this is a preceding, immediate preceding passage. Then Paul stood up and beckoning with his hand and said, Men of Israel, ye that fear God, give audience. The God of this people of Israel chose our fathers and exalted a people when they dwelt as strangers in the land of Egypt. And with an high arm brought he them out of it. And about the time of 40 years suffered he their manners in the wilderness. And when he had destroyed 7 nations in the land of Canaan, he divided their land to them by lot. And after that he gave unto them judges about the space of 450 years until Samuel the prophet. Well, that's I read it from our King James translation. When the ESV and the NIV say all this, THIS, it is very obvious that they want to include the Egyptian bondage. For example, in verse 17, Act 13, the God of this people of Isaac chose our fathers and exalted the people when they dwelt as strangers in the land of Egypt. So, land of Egypt, 400 years, and with an high arm brought he them out of it, Exodus. Then verse 18, and about the time of 40 years, so wilderness journey. Then verse 19, and when he had destroyed the 7 nations in the land of Canaan, he divided their land to them by lot, and so on. He talks about Canaan conquest. So 400 years of their life in Egypt. Then 40 years of wilderness journey and about 10 years in the land of Canaan. So it makes 450 years. It makes a perfect sense. So if we add all the years from such events, we may say that it was about 450 years. When I come to King James translation at this point, I'm not sure whether I'm in favor of this particular translation because it begins with and after that. You know, ESV and NAS, or NIV says, or this, then King James says, after that. Well, this or that, it doesn't matter. It doesn't make any difference. But what matters is that this or that is a basically singular pronoun, indicative pronoun. And Greek word for that is a neutral plural word, in fact. If you read the Greek Bible, actually that particular pronoun is a neutral plural word. And it is true to say that oftentimes in Greek, neuter plural pronouns or nouns can be translated as a singular form. But it doesn't have to be that way. Plural normally is to be translated as a plural rather than singular. Sometimes it is being translated as a singular. But in this case, there is no necessity to translate it as a singular word. In fact, it's in Greek. It's a plural indicative pronoun, and so. Demonstrative pronoun, I'm sorry. So, a singular word translation in this verse seems to cause a serious confusion, in fact. However, a singular word translation is a little bit of trouble, as I mentioned. It is because the singular demonstrative pronoun that can be understood to refer to one particular event written within the preceding verse, which is the story of the conquest of the promised land in verse 19. And it gives us an impression that after that conquest, so after that, God gave them judges for 450 years, which contradicts our simple mathematics. The NAS begins with, and after these things. So these things are proper translation of a neuter plural demonstrative pronoun. And so after these things, it seems to be a good translation which will spare us from further difficulties. And in fact, this translation goes very well with the Greek New Testament. Now, I will give you a literal translation from the Greek according to the word order in the Greek Bible. So this is my translation. And I just try to follow the King James translation as much as I can. And it reads as following. And after these things, about 450 years, he gave judges unto Samuel the prophet. That is the word order. After these things, about 450 years, he gave judges until Samuel the prophet. In order to understand it correctly, we need to know that in Greek language, word order really does not mean anything. Sometimes we use different kind of word order by putting something in the front of the sentence in order to emphasize the point. However, in Greek language, in the Greek New Testament, word order does not make any meaning change. It is a very different matter from a different way of understanding of a language from the English language. Because in English language, word order is extremely important. If I say, James drank a cup of tea, and I cannot change the word order, I cannot say, a cup of tea drank James. It doesn't make any sense. We cannot say something like that. However, in Greek, that is a possible thing. Not only possible, quite often it is the case. It is significant to understand the verse. It is because about 450 years may go with after these, which will make it saying about 450 years after these things. That translation is extremely plausible and very, very possible. So about 400 years after these things, God gave them judges until Samuel and so on. If we put about 450 years together with the last part of the verse, it will say, he gave unto them judges about 450 years. We need to understand these options. Then we go into the context to see what it means by after these things, because that's a neuter plural demonstrative pronouns. What are these things? It is not just one event, but bunch of them, plural, plurality is there. And in the context, Paul is talking about Israel's bondage in Egypt, which was about, for about 400 years. Then he speaks about wilderness journey, which was about 40 years. Then he speaks about the conquest of the promised land, which took approximately for 10 years in this case. And so if we put them all together, those numbers, it becomes 450 years. It seems that the context supports the view that 450 years is not of the period of the judges, but of the period from the Egyptian bondage to the moment of the appointment of the first judge. Then we see that there is no texture problem at all. And, we just counted about 10 years to be the years within the promised land, but as I mentioned, it can be round numbers, so the number may be expanded a little bit more and so on. So in this case, we do not have to say that there is any discrepancy in the scriptures, and it does a perfect sense. It does make a perfect sense. Well, the book tells us that God has never given up his people despite their sins. In times of spiritual and physical darkness, God provide them with judges to bring their hearts to him and to deliver them from foreign occupations. One thing that is very much outstanding from the book of Judges is that God is ever faithful. You know, do you remember the verse we are supposed to memorize? You know, next week, 2 Timothy chapter 2 verse 13 says, if we believe not, that's what the children of Israel did. Yet he abideth faithful. He cannot deny himself. Does the verse speak to you in any way? Does it make any sense to you? That's what God has done for the children of Israel during the days and years of judges. And that faithful God is your God. And it is my desire that all of us will not repeat the same sin and wrongs that the children of Israel did in their promised land, but rather we will be faithful unto the Lord, even unto death. Let us look to the Lord in prayer. Dear God, we are very grateful and thankful that you have given us the scriptures for us to meditate upon, to study upon, so that we'll be able to glean all the lessons that we must be able to know and must understand. Father, help us to be faithful, and we praise you that you are a faithful God. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.